So just we'll go through some of the answers that people gave us in terms of common clinical scenarios. And Dave, in terms of first-line therapy for a metastatic cervical cancer, most common regimen preferred by the investigators, CIS with paclitaxel bev. That was also the most common in the docs in practice. In terms of patients with metastatic disease who develop relapse 12 months after, for example, receiving chemoradiation therapy, including cisplatin, most people would go with carbo paclitaxel bev. And then in terms of second-line therapy in MS stable, obviously almost all they are, metastatic cervical, people are going with the FDA strategy of testing PD-L1 and pembrolizumab. So Dave, any comments about these clinical patterns? Does your practice match up?
Well, you know, I think Krish's study in 240 really changed the way that we treat patients with advanced or recurrent cervical cancer with the addition of bev with the survival advantage. And that was really the first step in us truly improving in survival benefit. But patients still do very well, and we're not curing anybody with a platinum doublet and bev. And they do even worse in the recurrent setting. We're really excited about a 15% response rate here. You heard Mike say, you know, this is the first thing that we had that works, and it's a 15% response rate. It's unbelievably consistent across products, recurrent cervical cancer, 15% plus or minus 5% with the checkpoint inhibitors. We start seeing better results when we start combining it with a CTLA-4 inhibitor. So in my practice, this is what I do outside of a clinical trial, but if they are PD-L1 positive, I am going to try to get them onto a trial with immune therapy, but looking at combination to improve upon that 15% response rate.
So Mike, Dave referred to, you know, strategies combining CTLA-4, PD-1, such as ipi/nivo.
Yep.
Any situation right now, Mike, where you think about ipi/nivo in metastatic cervical cancer?
Yeah, for a lot of reasons, I'm not a big fan of ipi. I think maybe I developed a bias of it when we were doing the phase two trial up in when I was up at Harvard, and Ursula knows this. And that was in ovary, and they may be fundamentally different, but it's a tough drug, a lot of GI problems. So using the combo in cervix cancer patients, I don't get too excited about it. I'm using single agent. And this whole debate really is what? It's a debate about the fact that we don't have any decent biomarkers. If we could identify the subset of patients in both cervical and even to a certain extent in endometrial cancer, MSI is a great biomarker, but anybody beyond that, if we could identify them, we wouldn't be having these discussions. PD-L1 is a very crummy biomarker in endometrial cancer. Here it's a little better, but if you look at the numbers, there's a 12% response rate all comers and a 14% response rate with PD-L1 expression. So it's really not all that great.
So I want to go through a couple cases of Krish's with cervical cancer and ask the rest of you to comment on these two cases in terms of whether you think they're typical, atypical. How about this 36-year-old lady, Krish?
Yeah, so this is a 36-year-old mom. She was in. She actually has flown in to see us, but she lives. I think it was Georgia. Yeah, Georgia, and she didn't have very, consistent cervical cancer screening for about 4 or 5 years, and then a couple of years ago, she was bleeding after intercourse. She was anemic. She had pelvic pain. She had a large lesion on her cervix. It was using the 2018 FIGO staging criteria. She was a FIGO 1B3, and this was 2018 was when FIGO issued these new staging, and so patients with 1B3 and above, meaning a lesion 4 centimeters or more, they're best treated with chemoradiation. So that's what she got. She was treated with platinum-based chemoradiation, CIS. She got high-dose rate brachytherapy, the total dose to point A, which is essentially the area of the perimetrial tissues, was 85 gray. What's important, though, is she did have some lapses in her treatment. She missed 8 appointments, and but still achieved a complete clinical response. So I think that's pretty typical. Then a year later, she 14 months after that, she had some flank pain. She stopped working as a medical assistant. Her performance status was 2. She was staying at home. She had a fixed pelvic sidewall mass. A scan showed that it was necrotic. She had a right hydro, which tracked with the flank pain she had, and a biopsy of a pulmonary metastasis confirmed squamous cell carcinoma of the cervix. Creatinine was abnormal. She was not able to travel, so I think that was probably the issue why she couldn't go on to a clinical trial. But we calculated her Moore score. David Moore was the two terms ago was the chair of the cervix cancer committee, and she had a Moore score of 3, which suggested there would be some benefit with anti-angiogenesis therapy. We boosted her nutrition, made her drink, had her drink 3 cans of Ensure a day, got her creatinine normalized with interventional radiology, and treated her with carbo-paclitaxel and Bev. And we used carbo because she'd previously seen cisplatin, and the Japanese non-inferiority study of carbo versus cis showed significant non-inferiority if they had previously seen cisplatin. She had a complete clinical response, but then represented with left supraclavicular adenopathy and bilateral pulmonary metastases. In this year, her combined positive score on the tumor for PD-L1 was 16, and she got put on Pembro 200 Q3 weeks. She had some enlargement of her mets after her second cycle. We thought maybe this is pseudoprogression because there were no other new areas of disease, and clinically she was stable, so we wanted to keep the Pembro going. She got 2 more cycles. She had a partial response and at that point. And then we were all under stress due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm. And so we spaced her out to 400 Q6. And the only toxicity we've had is some hypothyroidism. And I've got her on both T3 and T4 supplementation to manage that. And she's doing really well. Stable disease at this point, but I haven't scanned her.
So a couple of points, Dave, I'm kind of curious about. One is this so-called pseudo-progression, which you see sometimes where it sounds like in this case the lesions were getting bigger. And Chris, no new lesions, just the lesions were getting bigger?
Yeah, so our criteria, no new lesions, and if the patient's clinically well, we keep going.
And she was stable. Yeah. So again, do you see this in gynecologic cancers and cervical cancers, Dave? We actually had a question from one of the registrants also saying, do you believe in hyperprogression? So let's start out with pseudoprogression first.
So Krish is going after the holy grail, which is abscopal effect and pseudoprogression in this talk. So yeah, yes, you see it, and you see it very rarely. True pseudoprogression is probably about 1% to 2% if we look at the melanoma data. Maybe slightly higher. When I think pseudoprogression, Chris nailed it, right? Which is that patients need to not have clinical symptoms of progression. But most commonly, I think we see it is the lungs, potentially the liver, but the lymph nodes. When you think about this body's immune response, as we're allowing an increased immune response to these tumors, that if I see the lymph node get slightly bigger, I've had to remove people on clinical trial because they meet the criteria for clinically significant progression on lymph nodes, switch them over to standard of care checkpoint, and have that had them on them for years. So that's truly pseudoprogression. So you see it, but it is rare.
I've heard people say that it occurs more commonly in renal cell. I don't know if that's really true or not, but I'll ask Mike in a second. But what about the second part of this, Dave? Hyperprogression. There are these cases where people get checkpoint inhibitors and the cancer seems to take off. Of course, we see this all the time in cancer, period. So I don't know how you can tell, but
pseudoprogression we see in cancer. If patients can have progression very quickly, if you give them a checkpoint or if you give them a placebo or if you give them chemotherapy, we've all seen those patients fall off a cliff in a very short time. It takes Mike described a case of, bowel involvement with regards to significant symptoms. If you can't eat, you can't live.
So let's go to your second case very briefly, Krish, a 45-year-old woman. What happened with her?
So this patient, so this patient presented with stage 4B disease. So she'd never been previously treated. She had periaortic metastases that lit up SUV8. She had significant pelvic disease. We screened and enrolled her on KEYNOTE-826. She got randomized to platinum paclitaxel bevacizumab. You can see the doses there, and either placebo or pembrolizumab. And she's doing really well. We saw her by Zoom. They're not coming to the office, but they're still going to the infusion center. She's been doing well. Stable disease, if anything, partial response for a while and then stable disease.
So you don't know whether she's getting pembro or not?
I don't.
So let me ask you, as we were chatting in the with you,
I've tried to figure it out, but I can't.
Well, the thing I was wondering about is the issue of bringing people in for placebo control trials with infusions in the COVID era. So is this trial continuing right now? Are people coming in to get a placebo infusions?
Yeah, they are. So that's a great point, Neil. So the NCI is very concerned about this. Now, the KEYNOTE-826 is run through industry, and so it's not run through the NCI. But within the NCI and CTEP specifically, the Cancer Therapy Evaluation Program, there is some concern about the ethical ramifications of bringing people into the infusion centers, to the healthcare centers for intravenous placebo. So one of the trials that was ongoing in endometrial cancer looking at checkpoint placebo-controlled trial GY018 was put on hold a month and a half ago. This trial is fully accrued, but there are patients that are still coming in. Presumably some of them are getting IV placebos, but those studies have not yet been subject to this type of scrutiny regarding the placebo issue in the setting of the COVID-19 pandemic that Dr. O'Malley has found himself in.